Chapter 8. Shuffle Off to Bethlehem. There is an evangelical preacher on television who goes by the name of Reverend Terry. She appears to be in her early 50s and features a coiffure of which it has been said that it cannot be mussed, only broken. Reverend Terry is energetic and folksy, and uses a style of preaching modeled on early Milton Berle. When her audiences are shown in reaction shots, they are almost always laughing. As a consequence, it would be difficult to distinguish them from audiences, say, at the Sands Hotel in Las Vegas, except for the fact that they have a slightly cleaner, more wholesome look. Reverend Terry tries to persuade them, as well as those at home, to change their ways by finding Jesus Christ. To help her do this, she offers a prosperity campaign kit, which appears to have a dual purpose. As it brings one nearer to Jesus, it also provides advice on how to increase one's bank account. This makes her followers extremely happy and confirms their predisposition to believe that prosperity is the true aim of religion. Perhaps God disagrees. As of this writing, Reverend Terry has been obliged to declare bankruptcy and temporarily halt her ministrations. Pat Robertson is the master of ceremonies of the highly successful 700 Club, a television show and religious organization of sorts to which you can belong by paying $15 per month. Of course, anyone with cable television can watch the show free of charge. Reverend Robertson does his act in a much lower register than Reverend Terry. He is modest, intelligent, and has the kind of charm television viewers would associate with a cool-headed talk show host. His appeal to godliness is considerably more sophisticated than Reverend Terry's, at least from the standpoint of television. Indeed, he appears to use as his model of communication Entertainment Tonight. His program includes interviews, singers, and taped segments with entertainers who are born-again Christians. For example, all of the chorus girls in Don Ho's Hawaiian act are born-again, and in one segment we are shown them both at prayer and on stage, although not at the same time. The program also includes taped reenactments of people who, having been driven to the edge of despair, are saved by the 700 Club. Such people play themselves in these finely crafted docudramas. In one, we are shown a woman racked with anxiety. She cannot concentrate on her wifely duties. The television shows and movies she sees induce a generalized fear of the world. Paranoia closes in. She even begins to believe that her own children are trying to kill her. As the play proceeds, we see her in front of her television set chancing upon the 700 Club. She becomes interested in its message. She allows Jesus to enter her heart. She is saved. At the end of the play, we see her going about her business, calmly and cheerfully, her eyes illuminated with peace. And so we may say that the 700 Club has twice elevated her to a state of transcendence. First, by putting her in the presence of Jesus. Second, by making her into a television star. To the uninitiated, it is not entirely clear which is the higher estate. Toward the end of each 700 Club show, the following day's acts are announced. They are many and various. The program concludes with someone saying, "All this and more, tomorrow, on the 700 Club." Jimmy Swaggart is a somewhat older-style evangelist. Though he plays the piano quite well, sings sweetly, and uses the full range of television's resources, when he gets going, he favors a kind of fire-and-brimstone approach. But because this is television, he often moderates his message with a dollop of ecumenism. For example, his sermon on the question, "Are the Jews practicing blasphemy?" begins by assuring his audience that they are not, by recalling Jesus' bar mitzvah, and by insisting that Christians owe the Jews a considerable debt. It ends with his indicating that with the loss of their temple in biblical times, the Jews have somehow lost their way. His message suggests that they are rather to be pitied than despised, but that, in any case, many of them are pretty nice people. It is the perfect television sermon, theatrical, emotional, and in a curious way comforting, even to a Jewish viewer. For television, bless its heart, is not congenial to messages of naked hate. For one thing, you never know who is watching, so it is best not to be wildly offensive. For another, haters with reddened faces and demonic gestures merely look foolish on television, as Marshall McLuhan observed years ago and Senator Joseph McCarthy learned to his dismay. Television favors moods of conciliation and is at its best when substance of any kind is muted. One must make an exception here for those instances when preachers like Swaggart turn to the subject of the devil and secular humanism. Then they are quite uncompromising in the ferocity of their assaults, partly, one may assume, because neither the devil nor secular humanists are included in the Nielsen ratings. Neither are they inclined to watch. There are, at present, 35 television stations owned and operated by religious organizations, but every television station features religious programming of one sort or another. To prepare myself for writing this chapter, I watched 42 hours of television's version of religion, mostly the shows of Robert Schuller, Oral Roberts, Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, Jim Baker, and Pat Robertson. 42 hours were entirely unnecessary. 5 would have provided me with all the conclusions, of which there are 2 that are fairly to be drawn. The first is that on television, religion, like everything else, is presented quite simply and without apology as an entertainment. Everything that makes religion an historic, profound, and sacred human activity is stripped away. There is no ritual, no dogma, no tradition, no theology, and above all, no sense of spiritual transcendence. On these shows, the preacher is tops. God comes out as second banana. The second conclusion is that this fact has more to do with the bias of television than with the deficiencies of these electronic preachers, as they are called. It is true enough that some of these men are uneducated, provincial, and even bigoted. They certainly do not compare favorably with well-known evangelicals of an earlier period, such as Jonathan Edwards, George Whitefield, and Charles Finney, who were men of great learning, theological subtlety, and powerful expositional skills. Nonetheless, today's television preachers are probably not greatly different in their limitations from most earlier evangelicals, or from many ministers today whose activities are confined to churches and synagogues. What makes these television preachers the enemy of religious experience is not so much their weaknesses, but the weaknesses of the medium in which they work. Most Americans, including preachers, have difficulty accepting the truth, if they think about it at all, that not all forms of discourse can be converted from one medium to another. It is naive to suppose that something that has been expressed in one form can be expressed in another without significantly changing its meaning, texture, or value. Much prose translates fairly well from one language to another, but we know that poetry does not. We may get a rough idea of the sense of a translated poem, but usually everything else is lost, especially that which makes it an object of beauty. The translation makes it into something it was not. To take another example, we may find it convenient to send a condolence card to a bereaved friend, but we delude ourselves if we believe that our card conveys the same meaning as our broken and whispered words when we are present. The card not only changes the words, but eliminates the context from which the words take their meaning. Similarly, we delude ourselves if we believe that most everything a teacher normally does can be replicated with greater efficiency by a microcomputer. Perhaps some things can, but there is always the question, what is lost in the translation? The answer may even be, everything that is significant about education. Though it may be un-American to say it, not everything is televisable. Or, to put it more precisely, what is televised is transformed from what it was to something else, which may or may not preserve its former essence. For the most part, television preachers have not seriously addressed this matter. They have assumed that what had formerly been done in a church or a tent and face-to-face can be done on television without loss of meaning, without changing the quality of the religious experience. Perhaps their failure to address the translation issue has its origin in the hubris engendered by the dazzling number of people to whom television gives them access. Television, Billy Graham has written, is the most powerful tool of communication ever devised by man. Each of my primetime specials is now carried by nearly 300 stations across the United States and Canada, so that in a single telecast I preach to millions more than Christ did in his lifetime. To this, Pat Robertson adds, to say that the church shouldn't be involved with television is utter folly. The needs are the same, the message is the same, but the delivery can change. It would be folly for the church not to get involved with the most formative force in America. This is gross technological naivete. If the delivery is not the same, then the message, quite likely, is not the same. And if the context in which the message is experienced is altogether different from what it was in Jesus' time, we may assume that its social and psychological meaning is different as well. To come to the point, there are several characteristics of television and its surround that converge to make authentic religious experience impossible. The first has to do with the fact that there is no way to consecrate the space in which a television show is experienced. It is an essential condition of any traditional religious service that the space in which it is conducted must be invested with some measure of sacrality. Of course, a church or synagogue is designed as a place of ritual enactment, so that almost anything that occurs there, even a bingo game, has a religious aura. But a religious service need not occur only in a church or synagogue. Almost any place will do, provided it is first decontaminated, that is, divested of its profane uses. This can be done by placing a cross on a wall or candles on a table or a sacred document in public view. Through such acts, a gymnasium or dining hall or hotel room can be transformed into a place of worship. A slice of space-time can be removed from the world of profane events and be recreated into a reality that does not belong to our world. But for this transformation to be made, it is essential that certain rules of conduct be observed. There will be no eating or idle conversation, for example. One may be required to put on a skull cap or to kneel down at appropriate moments, or simply to contemplate in silence. Our conduct must be congruent with the otherworldliness of the space. But this condition is not usually met when we are watching a religious television program. The activities in one's living room or bedroom or, God help us, one's kitchen are usually the same whether a religious program is being presented or The A-Team or Dallas is being presented. People will eat, talk, go to the bathroom, do push-ups, or any of the things they are accustomed to doing in the presence of an animated television screen. If an audience is not immersed in an aura of mystery and symbolic otherworldliness, then it is unlikely that it can call forth the state of mind required for a non-trivial religious experience.